You're listening to the Heart of Giving podcast with Art Taylor, powered by bbbgive.org. Here we explore the motivations that form the basis of giving and service. We inspire generosity and celebrate the transformative effects that giving and service have on the human spirit and on community. The conversations featured on the podcast also uncover giving strategies that educate and provide tools to help listeners make impactful gifts of both their time and money. We hope you enjoy this episode.
Welcome to the Heart of Giving podcast, powered by bbbgive.org. Give.org is the nation's standards-based charity evaluator and your one-stop source for information on giving and reports on the most asked about charities. I'm Art Taylor, your host. Today, we're going to talk about education and some unique ideas that are out there to get people from underserved communities educated and have their education financed, in this case, by others who have wealth to provide for their education. We're talking today to our guest, Pete Cadens, who made a fortune in the cannabis industry and has now decided that he should give that money to society through his initiative to educate young people who don't have the means to attend college. We're going to talk to Pete about where this idea came from, how he intends to go about it, and we're also going to talk about his life and how he earned his money and issues that some people have with it, and how he explains why it's so important to not only give, but to feel an obligation to support those who didn't have the same opportunities as others. Pete, welcome to the Heart of Giving podcast.
All right, thanks so much for having me.
So, you know, your life has been, I would say, pretty fascinating. You grew up in a good situation, and you really took advantage of it. You made what many of us would describe as a fortune in your life, and now you want to give that away. There are some people, though, who would maybe take issue with how you made your money. One of the things we do in my class, I teach a class at Columbia University, the School of Professional Studies, and one of the things we talk about in that ethics class is tainted money, this concept of tainted money. You know, as a charity, should there be money that charities accept versus money that they shouldn't accept because it has some type of taint, either because of how it was earned or because of the person who earned it? And our students have to wrestle with this. The truth is, lots of charities wrestle with it too. But what I always come away saying is, virtually all money in this country has some taint to it. And it's just a question of what we want to do to either clean that taint or ignore the taint or do something with the money that, in my opinion, is better than maybe how it was earned. But in your case, you made a lot of money on cannabis. Tell me about what that means to you and how people should perceive that, in your opinion.
Yeah, it's a fair question, Art. And, you know, so I made some money in prior businesses as well. I built the largest commercial solar company in the United States prior to getting into the cannabis space in 2014. But yeah, I'd say the vast majority of my wealth is connected to the cannabis space. I have a little bit of a different purview on this one. I kind of open up my aperture a little bit and ask other people to do the same. I don't think the issue is that I created real wealth in the cannabis space, because frankly, cannabis is the oldest known form of medicine. It dates back 13,000 years, and archaeological digs where we've identified that our ancestors were using cannabis as a medicine all the way back 13,000 years ago. I have personally seen patients with cancer, AIDS, digestive disorders, spastic disorders use cannabis as a medicine and increase the ability to live a good life versus using a narcotic cocktail. And I believe that cannabis is a plant that is really constituted poorly as a Schedule I drug. And so I don't love debating that piece because to me, cannabis is a medicine and it's something that should be fully legal. The harder issue for me to reconcile is that I'm a middle-class white guy who became a rich white guy who took an industry that was built by black and brown people who got arrested and who's had their lives destroyed for doing the same thing I did. They got incarcerated and I created tons of wealth. That's harder for me to reconcile. And so when someone brings up that point, that's something I totally engage in. But, you know, look, I believe I made my money fair and square. I believe the cannabis industry is a legitimate industry. The discussion about the inequities of it is a difficult and harder and more ethically compromising discussion, though, I feel.
Well, let's have that one, because it's true. I think I read recently that there's something like 40,000 people incarcerated, maybe more, as a result of some marijuana-related charge. And yet, there are people like you who made a fortune off of it. How do we reconcile that?
Well, we have to repair the damage that was done. I mean, the 1994, Nixon and the Controlled Substance Act, Reagan, the war on drugs, Bill Clinton and the 1994-1995 crime bill that was also, you know, in fairness, co-sponsored by our current president, Joe Biden, destroyed urban communities. And, you know, we've taken some measures to reconcile that with the First Step Act, but a lot more needs to be done. I mean, you're right, about 40,000 people sit in jail today for some sort of marijuana-related offense. But if you looked back 20 years ago, when the stigma was even greater on marijuana, it was, you know, triple that. And so, you know, what we have to do is we have to more than just expunge criminal histories. That is not enough. You don't just, like, have, you know, your criminal history expunged and then have some sort of like 10-year gap on your resume and, oh, you know, great, we really help these people. No, we help them a little bit. But now what we need to do is we need to figure out three things. A, how do we get them the education they need to be able to compete in the cannabis industry one for one with rich white people like me? Number two, how do we get them the capital to be able to compete one for one with rich white contemporaries in the industry? And number three, how do we make up for lost time? And number three is the harder answer. I don't have the answer for that one. But we have a history of creating set-asides, regulatory set-asides in this country. I personally don't believe that set-asides work. In other words, setting aside a license for a minority class and saying, oh, we're trying to level the playing field. The set-aside itself does not level the playing field. You only level the playing field if the set-aside is buttressed by or supplemented by education and capital. And so I'm spending a lot of time thinking about that and thinking about how to augment opportunities for members of the black and brown community so they can compete one for one in the cannabis space. That's the only true form of repair that we can do here.
Have you seen any initiatives that are inspiring you right now? Or are we just, you know, really early in this whole idea?
The answer is no. I wish the answer was yes. I've seen some platforms here in Illinois as well as in New York that I think make the attempt to inspire. But I would say their results have not been inspiring, right? So the platform itself was set up to inspire and to bring in people from the minority communities who were impacted by the war on drugs. But the net of it is, yeah, they haven't done much. It's been pure mirage or optical illusion to this point. So it's a little early to answer that question. I'm hoping these programs and platforms go even further, and that we can provide some real well-funded incubation opportunities for black and brown business owners in the cannabis space. But to date, you're still sitting on an industry, the legal industry I'm talking about, that is like 2% owned by minority business owners. So again, you're talking about an industry that 20 years ago was built by black and brown people growing and dispensing out of their garages and basements. And they controlled, you know, arguably 70 or 80% of the illicit black market space. And they only control still today 2% of the legal space. We have a long road to hoe. We got a long way to go still with the regulatory framework and how it inspires and allows opportunity and affords opportunity for black and brown members of the community.
Well, you know, it's great that you are interested in trying to do something about that, because frankly, I think it's going to have to come from the industry itself if these kinds of opportunities are going to be presented for people. But, you know, what's really interesting about you is not so much how you made your wealth, which is what it is, but what you plan to do with it. I think you're getting a lot of attention because of your interest and your efforts to see more underprivileged people get educated and a foothold in our society. And one such initiative you launched in Toledo, which got my attention, you promised a group of high school students that you would pay their tuition, you know, once they graduated. And I would love to know what inspired you to tackle that, to just stand up and do that. And also, you mentioned, you know, during that announcement that you didn't see this as a gift. On this podcast, I talk a lot about giving and serving. But in your case, you see it as an obligation or responsibility. So I would love to understand your thinking that drives you to believe that this thing that we would most consider to be a gift, you consider an obligation.
Yeah, that's a great question, Art. Yeah, and you know, giving connotes you have a choice, right? It's at your option. Whereas responsibility means that you have an obligation. You have to do. You have no choice. When I thought about the setup of my life, here I am, a middle-class white kid who went to the best public high school in the state of Ohio, consistently rated the number one public high school in the state of Ohio, mostly white high school. 4.5 miles down the road is an all-black, underserved high school, rated one of the poorest high schools in the state of Ohio in terms of the poverty levels as well as the actual educational experience. And I always thought about that inequity. Like, those kids weren't less intellectually capable than me. Those kids weren't less talented than me. They just had less access and less opportunity than me. And so when you think about, like, how did I make this fortune? How did I create this success? The truth is that I won in life because other people lost. In other words, if those kids at Scott High School in Toledo, Ohio, that underserved high school, got the same access, had the same network, had the same educational training that I did, and they applied to the same colleges I applied to, would I have gotten into all those colleges? Probably not. And so, in fact, the setup is that I won in life because they lost. The inequities of our society enabled me to flourish and forced them to fail in some cases. And so I'm one of those people, like, I have what's called a high sleep at night quotient. I like to sleep well at night. And I don't sleep well knowing that I built my fortune on the backs of other people who failed because society failed them. And so because I want to sleep well at night, and that's a little bit self-serving, but I was like, you know what? There's that saying, Art, pay it forward. I kind of, in some sense, at least out of the gates when I first got achieved my real fortune, I like the notion of pay it backward. Who are the people and communities and individuals who gave me the tools and balance sheet and abilities to go out and succeed in life? And who are the people who suffered along the way as a result of me succeeding? And I got to pay it backwards. So that's why I went back to my hometown. That's why I went back to the underserved school. And actually, just to supplement what you said, I'm actually paying for now 2 classes of students. And it's actually not just the students, it's their parents as well. And the reason I bring that up and why that's so important is because when we solve for intractable issues in our society with our charitable work, a lot of times I feel like our solutions are one-dimensional. But poverty is multidimensional and multifaceted. And poverty is not one-generational. Poverty is multigenerational. And so I kind of looked at it and said, I can't solve poverty in this community with a one-generation solution, because all this generation of kids will become is just an anomaly. They'll become an exception to the rule. I wanted to create a trend, and that's why I created a 2-generation solution, and hopefully creates a trend that changes the narrative, the outcomes, and the opportunities in that community in Ohio. And then as we'll talk about later, I'm continuing to further that concept. That what I did in Toledo was kind of the appetizer. I have a full-fledged entree planned for later as well.
No, I definitely want to talk about that. So on this question of obligation, you basically feel that it's because others couldn't have the opportunity that you had. You had it a lot easier, and therefore, because of that, you sort of owe it to society to give something back to those who weren't able to compete and succeed at the level you could for lack of opportunity. I wish we could get all business people who've made it to see it that way. But fortunately, we do have people who do at least see it as a gift and the need to give. Now, when we think about education, this is one way of getting ahead, right? So you also mentioned not only high school and college, you also mentioned trade schools and other ways for people to prosper in a job. I mean, it's about 90 degrees in my house and one of my air conditioners are out. And it's hard to find someone to come and repair my air conditioner right now in one of my rooms. So we can't use this room right now. But just imagine, you know, the opportunity for young people leaving high school to be able to get a certificate and be able to work as a HVAC person, right? So there are these kinds of jobs, too, that people are failing to get opportunities to have and make a living in. And I'm glad that you included that as part of your commitment. So you have this larger vision, though, that you can combine your efforts with others and take this to a scale. And this is an important point because colleges and universities right now are looking for students from different backgrounds because the students that come from their traditional backgrounds are not there. They're not having as many children, right? So we need to make sure that there are opportunities for others, and colleges and universities are looking for students from different backgrounds. And we also know, and I had a chance to talk to Dan Porterfield about this, who started something called the American Talent Initiative. And the idea is that there are young people out here who don't even apply to certain colleges and universities because they don't believe, A, that they can get in, even though they can, and B, if they did get in, they wouldn't be able to afford it. And so they either don't go or they go to another place where they think they can get it paid for. So it looks like part of your vision is to try to deal with some of those issues. So let's talk about where we go from here, Pete, with your idea for scaling this idea of getting young people educated.
Yeah, and Art, to your earlier point about opening up the aperture, the educational aperture, to view this from a perspective of it's not necessarily just four-year degrees or even associate's degrees that, you know, are the ultimate benefit here. It's kind of an open architecture where students can choose from a variety of different educational opportunities, some of which are trade and skill-based, welding, forklift, transportation, distribution, logistics, coding. There's a whole suite of things that these students and their families can do to acquire skills and to double or triple their income opportunities versus working just an hourly job. And we need to afford those opportunities to them. I feel like we have a habit is a secondary and post-secondary educational structure of mainstreaming our students. You know, I know at Bucknell, I love Bucknell. It was a fascinating experience. I'm a very, very proud alum, but they mainstreamed me into accounting, finance, consulting. That was like, or investment banking, right? That was how we got mainstreamed. And by the way, the only people that showed up at the career fairs to recruit were accounting, finance, investment banking, right? So it's like, it was like a self-fulfilling prophecy to a certain extent. And similarly, there's like this notion that we're only really proud of kids if they get that 4-year degree. But there's a lot of kids, and I'm dealing with some of these kids right now with my work in Toledo. They weren't meant for 4-year degrees. They weren't meant for that work. But they're really capable with their hands. Their brains work a little bit differently. They're really technically able. And so I think we have to stop mainstreaming these students and start curating career opportunities to their skills and desires, and start curating educational opportunities to their skills and desires. And so that's one of the reasons why in my platform, which is called HOPE, which stands for Helping Our Population Educate. Education is a broad spectrum of things, not just four-year college and not just four-year colleges. And yes, I decided that what I did in Ohio was just an appetizer. And the entree was going to be a much bigger, big, hairy, audacious opportunity. And so I launched an initiative here in Chicago. And by the time this podcast comes out in September, we will be officially announced a $1 billion initiative. It's the largest place-based educational financing initiative ever even conceived, ever discussed, but it needs to happen. And, you know, it's like in Martin Luther King, when he wrote a piece, which is my favorite piece of all time, the letter from Birmingham City Jail. And he talks about the tranquilizing thalidomide of wait, where wait almost always means never. And I feel like that's kind of what we've been saying to the black and brown and underserved communities. It's like, someday we're going to come up with a structure where educational access and opportunity is fair and free for all. And, you know, we're going to do 2-year free associates programs for everybody and this and that. And Pell's going to increase. You know, we've been talking about that since I've been alive for 43 years. And you know what? And the time has come. We cannot wait any longer. And these kids and these communities are suffering. These families are being destroyed by gun violence and by poor health outcomes. Now is a time we cannot wait anymore. So that's why I'm deploying and putting a lot of my money on the table too. A $1 billion initiative to be deployed over 10 years. So basically one K through 12 cycle. So it's actually 15 years. But you know what, Art? I am going to be able to look at kids who are kindergartners in Chicago public schools when we make this announcement. And I'm going to say to that kindergartner, even though he or she doesn't totally understand what I'm saying, I'm going to say, kid, I have a kindergartner myself, so I know how to kind of talk to these kids. Kid, you're going to college and you're going for free. And that means tuition, room and board, books and fees, wraparound services and support, everything. And the reason we want to start with an initiative that's so big, so grandiose, but also targets young kids too, is because you have to create a narrative in the community that shows these kids that the light at the end of the tunnel is bright, right? Like, no matter what my parents did wrong, no matter where they ended up, no matter what their addiction may or may not be, no matter what zip code I live in, I am going to college. And that changes the way people act. It changes the culture in a community. I knew that I was always going to college and that I was going to be successful. I always knew that from the day I was born because of my luck and my birth luck, basically, right? So we got to give that same notion to these kids and embody them with the power of hope. And that's why I named my organization HOPE. It's not just an acronym. It means something. It means that we're giving hope to these communities that, frankly, for so many years have been hopeless. And so that's what I'm going to be spending most of my days doing. You can only make so much money before it's like, what else am I going to do with this? So my money is going to go towards impact orientation and towards changing communities, especially my communities of Toledo and Chicago that I really care about so much. And my hope is that this platform works and scales so that many communities decide that they have a moral imperative to follow our lead and to do the exact same thing.
Wow. So you're not going to be able to do this by yourself. So you're going to get others, I'm sure, to join you in this effort. How many people do you believe you'll be able to impact with this initiative, Pete?
Yeah, so we already have a board of 18 people from around the world, including individuals like a guy who I believe could be your next governor, Wes Moore, who just was the CEO of the Robin Hood Foundation. He was out at our board meeting here 2 weeks ago. Joyce Johnson Miller, who's probably the most prominent and prolific black female private equity investor of all time. Charlie Desmond, who won the Educational Martin Luther King Award 2 years ago. I mean, we have put together a world-class board of individuals. And we have recruited and hired a world-class team of educators and people to run this organization. This is a serious operation. I'm building this like I built my public companies, right? Because in the title of the person in charge, even though it's a nonprofit, is not executive director, it's CEO. Because we're treating this like a billion-dollar business. So we're taking it very seriously. We are going to help about 70,000 families over 1K through 12 cycle. And the cascading impact of that is even larger. There is a proxy for this, by the way. It's called there's scholarship programs. None as grandiose as the one we're talking about. But the one that I've studied in depth is called the Kalamazoo Promise. And in fact, the CEO of the Kalamazoo Promise, Vaughn Washington, is on our board. And in Kalamazoo, guess what? Over the last 15 years, they've been funding education for kids who graduate from Kalamazoo Public Schools. Lo and behold, public school enrollment has increased by 60%, and poverty, the poverty level, has gone from 39% to 22% over a 15-year period. Guess why? Because we're educating our kids and giving them opportunities. And so that's what we're trying to do here. I see this, Art, this is super important. When I think about our problems in Chicago, you know, our violence issues, our health outcome issues, I mean, we have a study that's been going on for a number of years here in Chicago where the people who live in Streeterville, which is kind of an upper class, mostly white neighborhood just outside of the Loop in Chicago, the life expectancy is 89 years old. 6 miles away in Englewood, a much more minority and underserved community, life expectancy 59. 30-year life expectancy delta, 6 miles. Unacceptable. But we're trying to attack these problems with very narrow. We attacked gun violence issues with, you know, trying to get guns off the streets. But at the end of the day, you're not changing culture if you get guns off the streets. And so I see education is as close to a panacea solution as possible. If we get our families educated with quality education, right, and give them access to free post-secondary so they don't incur a ton of debt, I believe the flywheel will start moving. Violence will go down. Health outcomes will improve. Mental health issues will be alleviated. To me, this is as close to a panacea, and that's why I'm investing so much time and energy into it, and capital into it.
Fantastic. I have to mention that Bucknell was one of a few schools that recruited me many years ago, and I chose Franklin and Marshall. But what's interesting about Franklin and Marshall is that the president is a woman by the name of Barbara Altman, who was formerly the provost at Bucknell. So we have Barbara in common.
We won't hold it against you that you decided not to become a bison, but we're happy that Barbara is helping you continue to build the platform of Franklin and Marshall. Yes, Barbara was a great
provost. She really is. She's doing a terrific job. Well, Pete, you know, I'm also on the board of a group in Philadelphia called the Philadelphia School Partnership, and we should think about how we can collaborate some too. But that organization is focused on creating great seats for young people in the Philadelphia school system and charter schools and parochial schools as well. And it also aggregates wealth to support schools in different ways so that they can achieve better graduation rates, better performance rates for young people. And so that I know firsthand from the work we're doing at PSP, how difficult it is to get young people ready for college. And I would love to know what you are planning to do to improve that, because you know, if we can't get young people ready, then the scholarship money will just sit there and, you know, we won't have accomplished our goals. So I'm glad to hear you talk about K through 12, because we have to get young people ready at that level too. And we are seeing, by the way, speaking of Franklin and Marshall, the young people from disadvantaged communities who attend Franklin and Marshall do as good or better than the general population of students. But that's because many of them come from very good educational backgrounds. They have programs that support them. And some of them, like the Posse Scholars and other organizations, KIPP, Du Bois, and other systems that really take their talent and hone it so that they can be prepared for college. And so I'm really curious to know, you know, how you plan to go about improving their education while they're in K through 12 so that they can be ready for college.
It's a great question, Art, and probably the most important question, because I talked earlier about the optical illusion of set-asides given minorities licenses to open up cannabis businesses, but it only being an optical illusion because the results aren't compelling. Similarly, we have to think about the same thing in terms of funding educational scholarships. I mean, if you look at the data tells us that 71% of white kids persist in a 4-year degree program to get that piece of paper at the end of the day with their name on them. But using the same metric, only 39% of Black kids persist in a 4-year degree program. And so, again, I go back to an earlier statement I made, which is, so do you think that's because the Black kids are less intellectually capable or less talented? Obviously, I don't think that, because that would be stupid and arguably very racist to think that. I believe they're as talented, as capable. They just don't quite have the infrastructure or the support. And many of these kids are first generation, so they don't have the cultural experience to kind of navigate through university, many of which are mostly white. So it's a little bit of a out of their comfort zone to be a Black person in a mostly white community. And so what you have to do is you have to support these students from early childhood development from the age of 3. And we know all the data about early childhood development is so critical. And Art Rolnick out of Minnesota has done such amazing work on this issue. But here's what we plan to do. We are going to, because we don't believe we're the answer to all that ails us from an educational perspective, and there's many great partner organizations here in Chicago, great agencies. Now, the fact of the matter is they're all kind of like one bad gala away from being out of business. They're small nonprofits, right? $4, $5, $6 million. But we're going to be their biggest funder and biggest supporter and leverage their resources. So, you know, there are nonprofit agencies that we're going to leverage around life skills training. There are nonprofit agencies we're going to leverage around financial literacy. There's going to be mentorship partnerships we have with nonprofit agencies here in Chicago that assign mentors to kids starting in 7th grade. You know, so when you provide these wraparound support services, including licensed clinical social workers to help these kids navigate some of their trauma and provide them with some trauma-informed education, you put them on a spot where they're more prepared. And we're going to be going through, similar to what the Posse Foundation does. The Posse Foundation tells these kids at the end of the junior year, you are a Posse Scholar. And the reason they do that is because in addition to their academic coursework in senior year, they also are put through a college training program, a prep program to prepare them for college so that when they get onto campus with their posse, they are prepared. We are also going to be engaging with nonprofit agencies to do that type of training at the end of junior year. So the goal is if I had one metric that I'm looking to achieve, it's I want our scholars, our HOPE scholars, to persist at the same or better rate than the average white student, so better than 71%. And I believe we can do that if we give the right wraparound support services as these kids grow up in these communities before they go off to college.
Pete, do you think this is something that's scalable in other communities? We talk about education, and there's so much debate about whether a program that works in one place can actually succeed somewhere else. And I guess that's why so much of our educational systems are locally led, you know, locally managed and run and funded to some extent. And I just wonder, because some states don't take the statewide resources and allocate it fairly across school districts, while others, you know, have, you know, more of a vision for how that money should be spent. And so, you know, you might find in some states, certain communities need the help more than others, and, you know, programs can't necessarily succeed or thrive because of how things are developed statewide. So I'm just curious, do you think this is something that's scalable? And if so, you know, what plans might you have in place to think about that down the road, maybe?
Art, it's a great question. I do think it's scalable, and you brought up an interesting point. One of the things that we plan to work on, in addition to funding, you know, the educational access for these students and families, we also believe that we have a moral imperative to engage in the policy framework. And one of the policy frameworks that you brought up, I think you insinuated it, but you didn't bring it up directly, but I'll just bring it up directly, is, and we have this problem here in Illinois, is we absolutely 100% must decouple property taxes from educational funding. Because The people who pay the most property taxes in the wealthy suburban areas are always going to have more funding for education. That is not equitable. And so we plan to, as the what will be the largest place-based educational financing initiative, we plan to play in the political realm. We plan to play in the political realm here in Illinois, and we plan to play in the political realm in Washington, D.C. and nationally, because we feel like unless you decouple educational funding from property taxes, we are always going to have significant inequities in the educational system. So we are going to work on that front. That is an important area for us to engage in. And, you know, I got to say, when I was growing up in Chicago as a young adult 15, 20 years ago, and I would travel for work and I would get out on the road and I would tell people I was from Chicago, you know, they would always say, oh, Chicago's the best city. I love Chicago. It's a cleaner, nicer version of New York. You know, I love the Wrigley Field, the Cubs, the lake, the beaches. I love Chicago. Unfortunately, that notion has given way over the last couple years when I travel to, oh, you live in Chicago? Oh, God, there are lots of murders there and carjackings and the taxes are so high, the city's broke. So, which is to say that the narrative on the city and the stigma about the city has changed a lot, unfortunately. But that leads me to believe that if we can do it here, given the negativity surrounding Chicago, that it gives a lot of credence to we can do it anywhere. If we can accomplish this here in Chicago, deploy $1 billion, change the narrative in the community, change the educational outcomes, reduce gun violence, a lot of other cities are going to look at it and say, in Columbus, Ohio, and Peoria, Illinois, and Little Rock, Arkansas, they're going to say, if Chicago can do it, I mean, that was like the Titanic. You know, that thing is huge. It's an ocean liner. It's hard to turn that thing around. They can do it there. We can do it in Little Rock, you know? So I do believe it scales, and I do believe that culturally people are going to see this as a beacon of hope and opportunity that they're going to look to bring to their own communities. That is really my goal, is if we can have a hope Little Rock and a hope Peoria and a hope Hartford, that would be my dream, and that's what we're angling towards.
Well, that's great to hear. And, you know, obviously politics doesn't just end at the state level. You have teacher unions that have a point of view about how education should flow and how those dollars should flow. You have charter school movements that operate a little bit differently than more traditional state-owned schools or state-sponsored schools. You know, we have all sorts of conflict among people and parents who basically want the best outcome for their kids. So there's all of those politics, and somehow you have to find a way to bring people together to get something done. What's your sense of your ability and your organization's ability to drive consensus for change? You know, education is probably one of the hardest areas, hardest institutions to bring about change, because there's so many people who are vested in the systems as they exist. And sometimes that recalcitrant, so to speak, has the negative effect on the students. What's your sense for how we can go about bringing people together through a consensus process to really make the kind of change
we need? Right, yeah. And this is something that King also talked about in his letter from Birmingham City Jail. I refer to it a lot because it's such a seminal piece in my development and my life and my study of the civil rights movement. And he talks about how people in groups with privilege over time work very hard to protect their privilege. And I see it in my own life. I mean, my parents wanted me to go to the best schools and me to get the best access, and I want my kids to have the best access. And so we take liberties that aren't overtly racist, but again, we're benefiting ourselves, and in the end, other people suffer as a result of that. And we got to be self-aware enough to recognize that. I talk about this a lot, and frankly, a lot of people get offended, especially rich white people get offended when I say that, but I'm just calling a spade. It's just true. If I'm willing to admit it about myself, then perhaps other people can open up and admit it about themselves as well. But King talked about it, and I think we very adeptly pointed out that privilege is something that we all work to protect for ourselves and our families, because those are the people we care most about. But, you know, here's the thing. I think educational access, I think I have an argument for just about anybody. You know, obviously it's, you know, I can make the argument to the people who live in the underserved communities. That's easier. You know, I think I have an argument for the people who live in the middle class neighborhoods. The tougher argument is the rich white people in the suburbs who are already getting great education. And some of these people only care about one thing, which is their tax bill. And I have an argument for them too. And my argument is as follows. So I think what you have to do is when you make compelling arguments about societal shifts and building consensus around societal shift, you have to be a little bit of a chameleon. You have to have an argument for everybody, right? And you have to know what stimulates that and inspires that person. So for the person who is going to be harder to convince, all they care about is their tax bill. My argument is as follows. I hear you complaining about the governor. You know, a lot of people here, I love the governor here, but a lot of people complain about the governor and rising taxes. The truth of the matter is the governor here was saddled with the financial situation well before he came into office. He has nothing to do with the tax regime here. If you want taxes to go down, if that's what you care about, if that's your issue, let me suggest to you the formula is pretty simple. You know, it just so happens in Illinois, we have one of the most underskilled and undereducated workforces, especially in the south and west sides of Chicago. So it's no wonder that Amazon doesn't want to locate their second headquarters here. And it's no wonder that a lot of other companies aren't moving here because we have an undereducated and underskilled labor force. And so, Mr. Taxpayer, if you want your taxes to go down, stop complaining about the governor and start investing in educating underserved minority families who can lift their abilities and lift their skills and lift their educational credentials and come back to Chicago and get quality jobs and create this system where employers want to come and locate and offer jobs here in Chicago. And then you spread the tax base over a wider swath of people so that you're not paying the biggest tax bill anymore. That, to me, is the formula. And so it's all about what the Tamarack Institute in Canada is doing in terms of poverty reduction. It's getting a lot of stakeholders around the table and finding the thing that inspires or compels each individual stakeholder. We have to have an argument for everybody at the table. And that's what we're going to work on with Hope Chicago.
That's fantastic. Well, look, Pete, we're going to have to take this conversation offline because we're out of time. But I really appreciate you spending time with me and sharing your vision and your background with our listeners today. And obviously, we're going to be paying a lot of close attention to what you're doing because I think the hope, using your term, is that we're going to be able to educate a lot of young people better than we could without the work that you're doing. And they're going to go on and build our country. And that's really what we need. And I just, again, am thankful for you. I'm thankful for your vision, for your compassion, for your sense of purpose, and also for your sense of obligation. That for you, this is not a gift. This is something that you feel compelled to do. So thank you for joining me, and I appreciate you. And we'll check in with you periodically to see where the progress is on your vision.
Please do. I'd love to have you all interview the incoming CEO of Hope Chicago. She's a world famous educator, and I appreciate the forum that you give people like me, Art, to tell our stories so that other people can follow and be equally charitable. So thank you for providing me this opportunity.
Well, we will definitely do that. You're listening to the Heart of Giving podcast. My guest has been Pete Cadence. And to all our listeners, we hope you'll subscribe or follow us on your favorite podcast platform. And we'd really appreciate it if you leave us a positive review, especially on Apple Podcasts. That helps us build audience. And if you want to help out a little more, you can become a sustaining donor on Patreon, patreon.com. Finally, we want to hear from you. You can reach us online on Facebook or just send us an email to heartofgivingpod@gmail.com. Thank you very much.
You've just listened to the Heart of Giving podcast with Art Taylor. Be sure to tune in next time for a brand new episode. To listen to our other interviews, visit heartgiving.podbean.com. That's heartgiving.podbean.com. Subscribe to our show on major podcast platforms. The thoughts and opinions expressed on this podcast are the views and opinions of the guests, not those of the BBB Wise Giving Alliance or program affiliates. This podcast is for information and educational purposes only and is copyrighted with all rights reserved. This podcast is protected by Podbean's terms of service.